You are about to journey against the current of contemporary thought and beyond the troubled waters of daily news to the very source of our extraordinary culture. You are going upstream with Cashel and Edge.
Hey, welcome to the world of today, the world of golf, this being the opening day of the Masters.
Hey, Jack.
We thought we'd dedicate it to golf.
I didn't even know you were a golf guy.
I am. I'm not a golf player.
Oh.
But I'm something of a golf spectator, but not a real hardcore spectator.
This will be interesting because I'm just the opposite.
Right. You're a player. I mean, you play. How often do you play?
I can't really divulge that to the public.
You figured that the drones from the NSA would be surveilling all our courses looking for you.
Let's just say that it's not often a week passes that I haven't tread the links.
Right, but there's a lot I think we could tell about America by talking about golf, and that's part of our subject today, not about golf per se.
Uh-huh.
There are a few things more boring.
Right.
Than someone telling golf stories.
But man, you should have seen what I did on 18. You know, the one that really goes over the hill and I hit. Oh, man, it was.
And even your friends are zoning out. They don't want to hear
this. Of course,
this.
Nobody wants to hear. That's like talking about your injuries, you know.
Right.
Yeah, my knee, you know, it really, you know, it pops. It pops a lot. Has been doing that since I've been about 52.
But okay, here's a worse something. And when you get older, you hear this. I shut these conversations down. Well, I had terrible bowel movement. Stop! Yeah. I don't want to hear it. You could talk about your external health, like if you break a knee or something, you know.
Uh-huh.
I always do it. Anytime I'm limping or something, it was from skiing at Gstaad. You know, you can romanticize your injuries. But anything that happens inside your body, I don't want to know about it. I simply don't want to know, you know.
I understand.
And that's like having a golf conversation.
That's right. That's right.
You don't want to know about it.
Well, I hope we can sustain this golf conversation, not bore the hell out of everyone.
No, I think there's things to be said. And I think, you know, for one reason, golf gives us metaphors that we can use in other walks of life, and it helps if people know them. So some years back, we've talked about this. I was the person who unveiled the fact that Bill Ayers helped Barack Obama write his literary masterpiece, Dreams from My Father.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember talking to some liberal friends about this and explaining how impossible it was for a guy who was like a C student in literature and college, I mean, who was a bad college, high school writer, to sit down and then write a book that has literary critics calling it, you know, the best writer in the White House since Abraham Lincoln, a literary classic. This is Dreams from My Father. I said it'd be like you being a double bogey golfer showing up on one Sunday in a green jacket and telling people you won it at the Masters.
Yeah.
It doesn't happen, right? Because I think great virtue of golf is that it's pure meritocracy.
Yeah, well, kind of.
You can't blame it on coaches.
Right.
Because you are your own coach. You can't blame it on referees because you are your own referee. That and the cameras looking at you when you try, you know, when you cheat on your own. But if you're a professional golfer, you can't cheat, right? You keep your own scorecard. You screw up your own score, you're finished. I mean, you'll get penalized. You may get thrown out of the tournament, even if it's a score against you, you know. So it has that advantage over all other sports that there is no.
It's anti-collectivist.
Totally. It is.
It's subsidiarity.
It is at that. It's like the PGA Tour has 150 entrepreneurs, right? Each week playing without excuses. I mean, they may have injuries or something, but no one wants to hear about those anyhow, unless you're Tiger Woods and you got them spectacularly.
And they got their own employees with them.
They have their own employees. They're their own heads of their own corporations.
Mm-hmm. They got their caddy and.
Yeah. Their coach. Yeah. And a lot of them are incorporated, right? They make good money, the good ones.
Mm-hmm.
The bad ones don't make any money at all. You know, they just got to scramble along and be happy to stay in the tour. The bad ones are driving, you know, RVs across the country, like pulling trailers. And the good ones are, you have their own private jets and their own little fleet of
It's just like when we pull up at the podcast convention.
Sort of like that, right? Exactly, right? People pull a step aside and say there they are. But then the question becomes, why don't other sports emulate that? Why do we not see that in other sports? And why do we see such a high degree of sportsmanship, right? There's a high degree of civility. I rarely ever see, I don't think I've ever seen, like a fight at a golf tournament, you know?
They need more of those, but go ahead.
Yeah, it's not like hockey or, you know, two golfers never get in fight on TV, you know? They may, you know, do a little backbiting and back in the thing, but no, it strikes me as the ultimate model for the way life should be organized in the United States.
Well, primacy of the individual, we need a lot more of that,
yeah.
For sure.
Yeah.
I don't know. There's so many reasons. I mean, it evolved from the British Isles.
Uh-huh.
From Scotland.
Right, which has now gone terribly woke. And they're going to start rewriting the rules of golf now that they're...
Right. But, I mean, that's where the rugged individuals came from, right?
Originally, sure, right. It was better that than, like, raiding British outposts on the northern border, right?
And then the fact that there's a level of money.
Yes.
That it has to be... a club has to be formed in order to create a golf course.
Right.
So there is that sort of an entrepreneurial aspect to it.
Right.
People have to set about and manage a club.
And that brings me to one of my favorite all-time individuals in the golf world. And that's Mr. Hootie Johnson. Do you remember him?
Mm-hmm.
He was the head of... Augusta National.
Augusta, yeah.
Where they played the Masters, which...
He was the one that, I think, stood down a couple of very strong objections.
Oh, it was a major story. He was... that they didn't want to cover.
Right.
Basically, Augusta, which is a private club.
Mm-hmm.
And it's set in Georgia. And at the time this all took place, they had black members.
Mm-hmm.
Like Tiger Woods and a couple other guys. But they didn't have any female members. This was about, when did they put the pressure? I think it was about 2003, maybe.
It seems about right.
And this organized group of feminists went after Hootie Johnson, was like a good old boy, classic. But he was a hard ass. He wasn't to be messed with. You know, he had a...
He was like the Sheriff of Arpaio of the golf world.
That's what he was. He was like the stand-up guy, the guy who says no to wokedom, right?
Uh-huh.
And so... they were strategizing, and he sensed what their strategy would be in advance, and he knew that their strategy would be to go to the sponsors.
Right.
CBS was at that time. CBS was probably still is televising it, and that big mm-hmm. contract, and he went to the sponsors and said, "We're not taking advertising this year." Right. And I said, "Well, yeah, why was that?" He said, "Because I don't want to put you guys on the spot, because this is going to be an organized feminist revolt. They're going to come to you. They're going to try to embarrass you, and they're going to try to force you to abandon us." And they agreed, you know. So Augusta National took on the price of this, took on all that sponsorship activity themselves.
He was pre Elon Musk. He told them to GFY right. In a different way, in yeah. the golf way,
in
the
golf
gentleman's
way.
Sport.
He was the John Galt of golf, you know.
Uh-huh.
And so they were totally dumbfounded. That
yeah,
they're,
how can you do that?
That's we're supposed to get away with this, you know. And the assault on Augusta was so orchestrated, so calculated. A couple female sports writers said, How come you don't have blah, 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 blah? And he said, we'll add women to the Augusta National at our own time, at our own pace. So, you know, F off, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then he said, I think they did 2 years in a row. They said to the sponsors, stay home. We'll take care of this, right? And then they realized that the world of golf was not going to bend to them. The women finally surrendered. They gave up. And then, it was classic. These are classic, you know, liberal, Democrat, feminist, whatever. And then about 10 years later, Augusta National finally admitted a woman. You remember who it was?
Condoleezza Rice.
Condoleezza Rice. A total in-your-face move.
Right.
They can't even celebrate it now because it's a Republican, right?
Right.
And she's black, right?
Right.
To celebrate that would be to further, signal their own irrelevance, right? And yeah, that's one of the reasons why I like golf. And golf breeds independence in its players. It breeds people who are capable of making decisions based on their own self-interest.
I kind of like the fact that it's one of the few sports you can smoke butts while you're playing. And nobody used to look askance.
Yeah, right.
You remember, it was like bowling. It's like, what other sports can you play at the top level, peak performance, while you're, well, you got a Budweiser in one hand and a Winston in the other.
And like John Daly, right?
I know. I love John Daly.
He was like about 100 pounds overweight and smoked and drank.
That's my favorite guy on the tour.
And he is also a big Trump guy.
Oh, yeah. He hangs out with Kid Rock.
Right.
I don't know if you've seen any of those interviews, but they're worth watching.
Yeah, I have. And that's another virtue of the PGA Tour. Mm-hmm. And forget about Liv for a minute. We'll get if that's the way to pronounce it, but of the golf world, is that it's overwhelmingly Republican, mm-hmm. right? One year, the Ryder Cup team refused to meet with Obama, right?
Yeah.
And Bill Clinton did have one friend on the tour. And if you remember, when he was president.
Well, I can't really think about it. I'm not a big follower of the tour, so.
Well, it was Greg Norman.
Oh, really?
He was an Australian. And it was that.
I kind of remember that now.
Yeah, I don't know if you remember the story, but at one point during his presidency, Bill Clinton really blew his knee out. He was staying with Greg Norman at his house, wherever Greg Norman lives in Florida. And he blew his knee out. And the story was going around that he was carrying Monica Lewinsky up or down the stairs when it happened. I don't know if that were true or not, but it made for a good story.
Sure you used a caddy.
But Greg Norman plays a major role in American history. And this I can't expect you to know. I'm probably the only person in America who knows this, but.
Do tell.
Well,
we have an exclusive here.
Actually, you do.
Another upstream with Cashland Edge exclusive.
Going way upstream. Making golf much more interesting than you think it could ever possibly be, and more consequential, right? On this, the opening day of the Masters. In the 1996 Masters, Greg Norman, mm-hmm. Bill Clinton's one friend on the PGA-friendly and the Republican-friendly PGA Tour, entered the final round of four with a 7-stroke lead.
Okay.
As he yawns, and he blew it. He lost, right? So afterwards, Clinton went around and told all of his staff, he said, under no circumstances will we be Greg Normanized, right? This isn't a re-election year. And he would walk around sometimes whispering, Greg Norman, Greg Norman, Greg Norman. Because after the election in 1994, Clinton had come back from the dead to, they lost the House for the first time in 40 years. There was talk of him not even being renominated. Bob Dole was leading him in a poll by 10 points. And then they fought back by going to Asia, China in particular, and trading military secrets for tons of money. It was one of the ugliest, most scandalous chapters in American history that people have chosen not to know about. That was, personally, I think it was November 1994 when the media stopped being journalists and started being propagandists. They overlooked this story purposely. And so, and this factors into my world, Because by July of 1996, Clinton had crawled back from the dead, was running these illegal ad campaign, and now was leading Bob Dole, right? Heading into November. And then on July 17th, 1996, TWA 800 gets shot down off the coast of Long Island. And now everyone knows we are not to be Greg Normanized. Greg Norman, Greg Norman, Greg Norman. They did whatever they had to do to get down that home stretch without blowing, as Greg Norman did, their lead. And that included just about everything. So that's Greg Norman's role in history.
Damn.
Aren't you glad you come here today and you learn all these things and you go back to home?
I knew he was up to something. He's no good.
You can't trust these Australian golfers.
No.
Yeah. No. Do you have a favorite golfer other than yourself?
Daly.
Oh, John, yeah, of course. How could he not be?
Yeah, I get a huge kick out of Daly.
Yeah.
I mean, I could watch him drink and smoke all day long, and shoot the bull with people. And you know, there's no line with him.
Right.
It's not like, no, I don't talk about or play golf when I'm doing these things.
Right.
It just seamlessly folds from the can of beer and the smoke to the golf course at any given time.
Right. He was that old school of golfer who came up like caddying and whatnot, you know, like the Lee Trevino school, you know.
I remember that first Open that he won, and I watched very, very little of any sport, including golf.
Right.
But I did see the end of that, and I heard a lot of people talking about what a ridiculous, you know, one-off that was, and boy, he'll never do. And I thought, God, no, he's going to be a presence forever.
Right, right.
I mean, that guy, he has a unique approach to the game.
But it's also one of the few games in which you could win being 100 pounds overweight. You know?
It's like bowling, yeah. That's one of the things I love. It's like, he's easily that. And I know he's been carrying around some cancer for quite a while now.
Have you ever met him?
No.
You know, and speaking of this.
I will, though.
Speaking of cancer, and this being the date, August 11th, we have to acknowledge what happened today. April 11th, rather.
Okay, what happened?
Have you not heard this news?
What?
And it's a sports related.
Oh, yeah.
O.J. Simpson.
The juice.
The juice. Ran out of juice.
Well.
What a shame.
The depressing thing is he never had a chance to find the killer.
Well, you know, the Babylon Bee headline was O.J. Simpson goes to heaven to ask God to help him find the Nicole's killer. That ain't going to happen. That ain't going to work. We could do a whole show on that, but it's...
Well, why did he die?
What did he die of?
What did he die of?
Prostate cancer.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah, yeah.
Huh.
I don't know. So it's... he was 76 years old, so had a very interesting life. It's 30 years since the fatal day that he ended the life of Ron Goldman and Nicole Brown Simpson. I've got it. What a major part in all of our lives that stupid incident played, you know?
Did you write a book on it?
Not yet. Actually, it was too well covered, right?
Yeah.
I write books about things that the major media leave on the table.
Well, for all I know, you had turned up something that nobody knew about and wrote a book
about
it.
I did. I was the guy who discovered that it was Colombian drug dealers who killed Nicole Brown Simpson and Ron Goldman. I was one who introduced. No, I didn't do that.
I was going to say, I didn't know OJ was into that.
No, I was. It took me a long time to get into that story. But once I did, I was mesmerized. I was hooked. And I remember listening to the trial, the whole, you know, the closing arguments, everything, the whole thing, you know. And then, like most Americans, I remember where I was when I heard that. He was acquitted, right? And was not as shocked as most Americans, because I have a little more jaundiced eye toward the American justice system. But, so Yeah, maybe we'll do another whole show on OJ one of these days, you know? Were you into OJ at all? Or
I followed it. Again, I'm spectator, sports spectator. I'm a one on a 1 to 10. I don't care.
Is it right? Yeah.
Yeah. Like you, I can talk about pre-1970 baseball.
Right.
Major League Baseball.
Yeah.
Had a lot of baseball cards when I was a kid, knew all the stats.
You smell the gum?
Oh, man. Went way back to, you know, through my dad and his, my dad was a sports guy.
Yeah.
He was a stringer for the UPI at the A's games.
Yes.
Municipal. So I used to go to those games. And so I go back with that. But other than that, when I was through playing, I was through caring.
Yeah. That's interesting. It's probably helped keep your sanity over the years, you know, so.
Well, it saved me a lot of time.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I've talked about it before, and I know it doesn't make me any friends, but I like to remind people that we're essentially at war right now.
Uh-huh.
We've got some serious stuff at our on our lap.
Right.
I don't see anybody cutting back on the entire weekend devoted to watching blah, 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 big sports center, blah, 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 brought to you by Pfizer.
And right. Well, we're not out killing your adolescents. We're not supporting your sports teams.
But it's way overdone. I just made a conscious decision a long time ago. I was sitting in some place and they had the table tents up. Here's the KU schedule. Here's the Chiefs schedule.
Right.
Here's the basketball schedule. I'm looking at all that, and I'm going, this represents like 8,000 hours.
Right.
And I know most of the people I know aren't going to miss any of these.
Right.
They're going to see the game of the week. They're going to see their college team. They're going to see the college tournament. They're going to see the women's this and the – it's like, guys.
Well, see, I can boast of being proudly indifferent to football. Including the Kansas City Chiefs, their success.
Yeah.
I watch golf. I only watch like the last few hours of every, like Sunday afternoon, you know, if it's close.
Well, it's great sleeping background.
The rest of it. I mean, I had.
And now Weiss Golf is approaching the fairway. It's like.
I once had the flu when the Masters was starting. I said, what good timing. I just sit in front of my.
How lucky I am to have the flu.
Right.
Well, how's your team? Your one team that you follow.
Well, they made it to
Purdue
the finals.
Basketball.
They made it to the finals of the NCAA championship.
And did they lose?
They lost. Yeah. Now, and
I'm
that's,
sorry.
Now that's the problem. Like there are 350 teams in playing college basketball.
Okay.
349 are going to end their season with a loss. Right.
Who won?
Connecticut, University of Connecticut, second year in a row. So. It was no shame in losing, but it was nonetheless it was it's a loss.
Were you depressed?
No, less than you'd think. I'm pretty philosophical about it. I want to get back to golf, though. I got a question for you. You should know this is because there's an interesting element in this.
All right.
Who is the best presidential golfer ever?
The best presidential golfer ever would have probably been. Taft.
By weight?
Yeah.
Yeah, we could hit the ball further.
Or was it Cleveland?
Yeah. I don't think they had golf.
It's one of those big guys.
Here's the answer. I'll back into the answer. I was talking to one of my liberal nephews last summer, and I said, this president was the best presidential golfer ever. And no way, right? He says. I said, check it out. So he pulls out his phone, starts Googling. He says, damn, you're right. It's Donald Trump.
Oh, Trump?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, I've seen a video of him playing. He's a powerful guy.
And Clinton was apparently the biggest cheater on the golf course.
Oh, I've heard this from everybody. Everybody that ever played with Clinton.
Yeah. So there is some.
I use that foot wedge a lot.
Yeah, right. See, in golf, of course, you are your own referee, so you're not supposed to cheat. Cheating in golf is. Especially if you're playing for money or something, it's like a cardinal sin. I mean, it's.
Yeah, people only care if you're playing for money.
Right.
If some guy's going to cheat, Usually it's just because he sucks. And he's just out there.
And you're jacking around. And everyone may, like sometimes, you know, like when I play about once a year and I'll say, let's play by Jack Nicklaus. And they said, what's that? I said, did you ever see Jack Nicklaus lose a ball, right? So if he's that good, he doesn't lose a ball because someone's out there, they got a galley out there finding his ball. I said, let's just imagine we've got people out there finding our ball and they find their ball. And that way we're not holding up the people behind us, you know, looking for
that's good. It's good to move on play. Keep the play moving.
So if you all agree to cheat in the same way, then it's kind of equal.
Yeah, and that's a good way to play. I mean, you know, if you all agree on gimmies on the short putts and you agree on playing it up or the leaf rule or whatever you want to throw at it, depending on the conditions of the course, people just make those agreements.
And if you swing and miss, it's a practice swing, you know. That when you really
might have a mulligan.
Yeah. And the very, very concept of mulligan is useful, especially for Catholics, because we're allowed mulligans in our life, you know. And we get to hit the ball over again. Go to confession, hit the ball over. But I wrote an article about a week ago that got much more attention than I expected and much more flack than I expected. And the article was, why are there no gay golfers on the PGA Tour?
Oh. Yeah, well, what did you...
I'll back this up in saying, before I wrote it, I looked up gay golfer, right? And what I found is this guy who is a Japanese descent, grew up in Hawaii, right? Made one U.S. Open, you know, he came in, didn't make the cut. Played in two other PGA tournaments, and then played three tournaments. And that was the end of his career. And now he's the pickleball pro at some resort, right, in South Carolina.
Well, there you go.
From golf to pickleball. And that was it. That was the only gay golfer they could identify, right?
What I want to know is why are there no straight pickleball players? I'm sorry. I didn't mean that. To all of our pickleball playing friends.
All of our gay pickleball playing friends.
Yeah.
The very name of the game, pickleball, you know, let's face it. No, so then, my thesis, you can imagine what my thesis would be. Can you or anticipate it?
No, I can't even imagine.
Well, and here's what happens. If you watch golf on TV, you'd see that at the end of the tournament, right, the guy wins. And there's this beautiful wife slash fiance, whatever. Well, usually wife. They tend to be more married than other people their age. Beautiful little toe-headed kids run out, big embrace, blah, blah, blah. But there's never like some dude running out and embracing a golfer. And all the golf tournaments ever been played that's been televised, that's never happened. And?
It doesn't happen a lot in NASCAR either.
Yes, have not. You are right. I have not seen that in NASCAR. So there's another sport, but they all have something in common. NASCAR has something in common with golf that basketball and football do not have. There's a dynamic going on.
Collegiate. There's a collegiate association that's strong. It's not in golf. It's not in NASCAR.
I would back it up. I would back it up to the fact that no championship golfer today, for the last 20, 30, 40, 50 years, has grown up without a father teaching him how to play golf.
They're right.
Yeah, every one of them. And you look at their bios. You know, look at someone like Tiger Woods, for instance. I mean, just his is a classic. His father had him out there at two or three. And so I just went from bio to bio to bio to bio of all the great championship young guys today. You know, Rory, even, you know, guys like Rory McIlroy's Irish, Jordan Spieth, you know. And the same one. Well, I have to thank my parents, especially my father, for teaching me how to play, blah, blah, blah. It's a father-son game. Just like NASCAR, right? If you don't have a father in a home, you're not learning how to do that stuff.
That's right.
You can't even drive a stick shift, right? That's why, you know, today, of course, if you want to, the greatest preventive against car theft is to have a stick shift.
Because they don't know how to drive.
You're lurching that block, right? Trying to steal your car. They see that stick then and say, oh man, that ain't doing it. And why can't they drive?
Yeah.
Because they don't have fathers in the home, right?
Exactly.
So I advanced this thesis.
Uh-huh.
And my argument is that, you know, while the cause of homosexuality is not formally and officially known, I think that there's a good case to be made that the presence of a loving father is an almost a sure guarantee that your son will not grow up to be homosexual.
Interesting, Dr. Casher.
And that was greeted with, you know, right, homophobe, right? And I had this one, and this is on Facebook, where you have some control over the people who are communicating with you, as you know. Lloyd, by the way, often posts pictures of himself on golf courses. So
I do.
Your audience, this audience may be shocked to know that, but that is true.
It's true.
And I always do a little like there, you know, and you show yourself in, all usually with other buddies, you know, and proving to the world that you have friends and that you have a life outside this studio.
And it's kind of I'm playing golf on a nice day in February, and you're not.
That's part of it. Facebook is all about spite, right?
Yeah.
It's all about saying, here's the things I'm doing and you're not doing, you know? That's why whenever people travel, they always post pictures of it.
Well, I've got obligatory ones that I have to post.
Yeah.
If a buddy gets a hole in one.
Sure. No, I get that.
And I've had two of those in recent.
Two buddies do that.
Yeah.
Yeah. Have you ever done that yourself?
Yes.
You have had a hole in one.
Yeah. Interesting. Kind of an interesting hole in one story. My hole in one was about, I'm going to guess, 12 years ago.
Yeah.
At the golf course right next to the Rose Bowl. In Pasadena.
Huh.
And I was playing with a neighbor of mine there in L.A.
Yeah.
And some guy we got paired up with, an old guy from KCK, who happened to be out there.
Yeah.
And, yeah, got myself a hole in one there.
And how did you feel when that happened?
Momentarily elated.
Yeah. And then depression sank in. Soon afterwards?
Just kind of forgot about it.
When you got an eight on your next hole.
And, you know, I put the date on it.
Yeah, signed it.
Signed it, put it in my pocket. I've got it at home.
Posted prominently over your fireplace.
It was kind of a crappy golf ball that I got out of my bag, unfortunately. I didn't have a cool, like a Titleist Pro V1. It was a noodle.
One of those golf range balls with a red stripe.
It wasn't that bad, but it was kind of an off-brand.
The kind you hit while you're looking at a lake between you and the hole, you know? The kind of float if you hit them when it hit them right and they skip across. Well, that's memorable.
I will say, state right now, officially on this podcast, that I am going to have another one this year.
You think?
Oh, yeah.
To me, when I played, a par was my hole in one. A par, it was Miller time when I parred a hole, you know? I was happy with a bogey. But double bogey I could live with. The bogey, celebrate. Par, I mean, record books, you know? I mean, that's my level of golf, so. But, I posted this on Facebook with my thesis. There was no odd homing, there was no hostility, no...
Mm-hmm.
You know, gay jokes or like, you know.
Right.
What's the advantage of like gay, lesbian golf jokes, which we won't tell in here. In all innocence, I wrote the article, I posted it. Now, there are some people on my Facebook friends list who guys like who I went to high school with, say, who are, you know, live in New York and are politically different. And, so this one guy who I hadn't seen in a long time, hadn't talked to in a long time, but he's on my Facebook page. And I should, a tip off is this. His Facebook picture to this day, and if he's listening, I'm sorry, Tim, but you deserve this. He has a black face mask right up to his eyes, right? And written on the face mask is this, wear your damn mask, right? Still wearing it to this day, right? And when you look at him, it looks like he's in blackface. So right out of the chute, he goes, you're a homophobe, right? This is homophobic, bigoted. I'm shocked at this bigotry, right? And then Usually I don't respond. Doesn't pay. Certainly not on Twitter. Sometimes on Facebook, because you know these people. And so I just responded, where's the homophobia here? I said homophobia means fear of, right? Mm-hmm. And I said, I may be phobic about beets, and I may be phobic about bats, but I'm not phobic about gays, right? I've known gays all my life. Where's the homophobia? And
dummy with a mask on.
Yeah, I should have said that. What the hell is with this mask? He lives in New York City. Right.
Right.
He's like a social justice lawyer or something.
You know? Good. I hope he enjoys himself.
Yeah, right. I mean, and when you go to, I was in New York last week, and when you walk around New York now, and it's not the city it was, you could see that. But when you look at all those big old apartment buildings and you think that people locked themselves up in there for a year or two and didn't even allow themselves to go to Central Park or whatever, you know, and you're thinking, these people are sick, right? And so I got into a discussion then, and then one other Facebook friend jumped in and says, yeah, I think Tim's right. I think this is homophobia. I said, okay, a couple questions. You know, where's the phobia? What am I afraid of here? And B, why the ad hominems, you know? Why not attack my argument?
Mm-hmm.
Why not say, Jack, no, that argument is wrong? Because you don't know, right? Mm-hmm. It's not like there's they have a definitive answer as to what causes homosexuality. Then I got the one guy backed off. So I'm sorry, yeah, I jumped in. But the face mask guy wouldn't back off, you know? He was we'll talk more about that next week on our show.
Yes.
projecting our values onto other people. But
really, when somebody ad hominem attacks you on your wall,
right,
on Facebook, you just need to block them and unfriend them.
Yeah, you can unfriend them.
Just immediately. Gone.
Right.
You're gone. Because that's a rudeness. It's like showing up at your cocktail party and, you know,
peeing on the punch bowl.
Exactly.
No, it's an incredibly rude thing to do.
It is. And it's immature. It's childish.
Yeah.
But look at what you're dealing with.
Right.
Look at this clown with the face mask on.
Yeah. And the odd
telling
thing,
you, right? Wear your damn mask.
And at first glance, when you sort of see that little picture, he looks like he's in blackface.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I have never unfriended a legitimate friend or relative.
Hmm.
I've unfriended people I don't know who are just being obnoxious.
You're just a virgin, Jack.
No, but this is typical of our side. The studies I've seen show that the left is three times more likely to unfriend people whose political opinions they disagree with than our people on the right. And we've seen that.
Oh, of course. They don't want to hear them.
Right.
Can't.
Right. And so what happens is that, I don't know if you saw it this week, where the guy from NPR.
Yeah.
Did you read that article?
I didn't read it. I saw the headline. I knew that he came out as declaring he was a longtime guy, and he said it's gotten ridiculous. And,
yeah.
Yeah.
He's a 25-year veteran. His first name's Yuri Berlinski. I think that's his name. And he goes chapter and verse. You know, he talks about Russia collusion. He talks about the Hunter Biden laptop. He talks mm-hmm. about the COVID response, right? Mm-hmm. And then he talks about the evolution of NPR over the years.
I could have written the story. So
I said, we all knew.
I didn't read it.
Right.
Because
no, you didn't need to.
I don't need to read this.
What was more interesting than the article itself were the comments.
Oh, I'm sure.
On their pages, right?
Oh, yeah.
And
triggering. Oh, my God.
And he makes his case. So he starts off, and this is sort of de rigueur for people who are taking their first bite on that red pill, you know? Oh, I have Trump. I hate Trump. Blah, blah, blah. I'm a good liberal. I eat yogurt, and I live on the Upper West Side, and I, you know, do all
I recycle.
Yeah, right. I wear masks, and I do all the things, and I eat granola, and, you know, all those other kind of, you know, I drive an EV, and I have a sign out in front of my house that says, this house we believe. All those things he has to establish so that what he says afterwards will have some credibility with that world, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
And but as with the argument about gay golfers, his audience did not want to hear what he had to say.
Mm-hmm.
The rebuttal, the guy writing the rebuttal for NPR is the guy who went public when the Hunter Biden laptop story first broke and said, at NPR, we don't consider this story newsworthy and we're not going to give it any space. He's writing the rebuttal, right? He is the subject of the original argument.
Good example.
Yeah.
We've talked about this subject before. It sounds like a bunch of angry adolescents that are mad at daddy. The NPR feed, the national feed, has gotten ridiculous.
Yes, and that's what he said. He goes into detail where every article, every bit they do now focuses on these, you know, half dozen identity things.
Anytime you push that button,
right,
in your car, it's going to be some victim thing that they're grinding and grinding on, or it's going to be climate change, which, you know, you think about that climate change thing that they've put out there. It's a huge canard. It's right. Ridiculous.
Yes.
And they use it as a stalking horse.
Right.
For all that they do.
Yeah.
And all these things that they want to, you know, silence everybody about. But what I realized the other day is when it comes to the international globalist criminal cabal,
right,
the payoff, I was thinking, well, why this ridiculous, absurd climate change? How does that – these are the very people that are polluting the environment.
Uh-huh.
They're the very people who are – dropping things from planes, polluting the water, Monsanto chemicals.
Right.
They are doing all this. Like in every other case, when you see them coming out, it's projection.
And that's
they're covering it all.
Right.
They are killing the planet and the people.
Well, you know, the last time I listened to NPR, I had a rental car. And I didn't have Sirius on it, so I was just like looking for something. I was driving to Daytona Beach of all places from Tampa. And they said, next up, we're having a story on lacrosse, right? I said, okay, something other than the friggin', you know, beating me over the head with DEI stuff. And then it comes up with, there's a black lacrosse team. Stop it! I said, stop it, right? So here's the ultimate crazy golf story where DEI and golf meet, right?
Okay.
And
not often.
No. About 5 years ago, the PGA, you know, Professional Golf Association, decides to sponsor a HBCU golf tournament, Historic Black Colleges and University Golf Tournament. Totally, you know, funded and everything. And, you know, and so, and I wrote an article about this. It was so hysterical. And then I went back to see how it had progressed. Well, there was no more talk of it because any one article exposing it showed the absurdity of it. The team that wins is a team from Bethune-Cookman University, historically black college and university. Do you know how many black people they have on the golf team?
Zero.
Zero. Do you know how many Americans they have on their golf team?
Probably none.
Zero. They imported golfers from Sweden, right?
Sweden.
It's like a parody of the National Lampoon, and it's because to go to a historically black college university, you don't have to be black, right?
I didn't know that.
So, and these are scholarship players.
Okay.
So they take their scholarship money because they want to be competitive. And, you know, American white golfers.
Boy, there's a lot of jokes in that.
they reach out to Sweden and import these Swedish golfers. Actually, I should say only 5 of the 7 were from Sweden. Like 2 were from like Belgium or someplace. And they're all blonde guys, you know, playing and winning the HBCU minority golf tournament. But and then the great quirk is that. In the individual tournament, right,
Mm-hmm.
So they have the team tournament, and Bethune-Cookman wins. And the individual tournament, only people of color can compete.
Really?
Yeah. So the guys from the—
Wow. So they kind of deserved that, didn't they?
Right. So the guys, the winning golfers from Bethune-Cookman couldn't play in the individual one. I mean, it was not impossible. I mean, they could have played. There was not like an overlap or a conflict of time, right?
Wow.
They were just naturally excluded. So the guys who got to play in the individual championship were people who had played on teams, right? Probably losing teams that weren't very good. And who wins the minority, the person of color tournament? A guy from India, right?
Oh, so he was the other kind of—
I guess he got tired of— I guess he couldn't spell very well, so he gets put on a golf team instead, you know? So
wow.
I just saw a picture of that. I think Elon Musk posted this. Of they had a an annual geography bee, right?
Uh-huh.
And the 8 top place winners were all Indian, right? So this is in America, right?
Okay.
So, you know, I just along the, I saw this old poll the other day. It said they were interviewing young protesters of, you know, Gaza-friendly protesters.
Uh-huh.
And they asked them, where's the river and where's the sea? From which river to which sea, right? More than half of them couldn't get either one of them.
Oh,
right.
Of course. I saw that.
You just get answers like—
Well, you know, there's been integration in golf that I think has been done in an organic—
Totally,
you know,
organic way. Right?
And I remember I was in L.A. when Tiger Woods came into the four. And the white guys were so excited about the fact that— You know, we talk about Obama and the magical Negro effect.
Right, right.
It was much stronger with Tiger Woods.
Yes.
These guys were giddy.
Yeah.
They were silly.
Right.
So excited about Tiger Woods.
Right.
I remember I was on a subway in L.A. and some old white guy and some young black guy, they didn't know each other at all.
Yeah.
They were strangers, and we were all kind of crammed into this thing.
Right.
And this old white guy, how about that Tiger Woods, huh? Huh? How about that? And the black guy's like, yeah, it's great. It's really great.
Well, you know, to Tiger Woods' credit, I mean, he's led a troubled life in some ways. But I think this is the cue for us to— it's my musical intro. Jack, you got 2 minutes. Get out of here. To his credit, he refused to play that game, right? And so Bill Clinton wanted him to come to, where was it? I don't know, Yankee Stadium or Met Stadium, wherever, for the 50th anniversary of Jackie Robinson's introduction, right? And Woods refused. He said, I'm no Jackie Robinson, right?
Good.
There were black golfers came before me who had to pay their dues.
Yeah, Calvin Peet was on the tour for a long time.
Right, Charlie Sifford.
Yeah.
And he said, the worst thing that's ever happened to me is someone telling, like, when Fuzzy Zeller told a chicken joke.
You know? Yeah.
And
Fuzzy Zeller told a joke that it was Tiger Woods' turn to pay for the meals in the clubhouse, and so it was going to be fried chicken and watermelon or something like that.
And he got tons of trouble for it, you know. But Tiger Woods got to roll off his back, and then when he's on Oprah, he refuses to disown his Asian mother or the fact that his father is like maybe 3/4 black and 1/4 white. And he became a pariah in that world, mm-hmm. at least in the world of the truly woke left, when they wouldn't try to exploit him otherwise. But anyhow.
So you got Vijay Singh. You got all these guys
from all over the international. Right.
And nobody ever makes a deal out of it in golf. I mean, the politicians, like you say, will try to.
And some of the guys from Fiji or Indonesia, et cetera, are blacker than any African Americans, you know? And it's no one's going to give you a place because you're black. If you don't earn it, it's going to be obvious. And life will be very difficult for you, especially, if you're trying to do it. But anyhow, that's what I know about golf. And I thought it'd be appropriate today in honor of, because for the last, 30 years, O.J. Simpson has been hunting America's golf courses for the killer of the real killer of Nicole Brown Simpson and
Ron Goldman.
And that quest is at an end. So There we be.
So there's peace now.
There is peace in the world. Until next week, when we'll see you again here on
Upstream with Cashel and Edge.